My name is Karen Cloperdans. We'll be reading Luke 1, 67 through 80. And his father Zechariah was filled with the Holy Spirit and prophesied, saying, "Blessed be the Lord God of Israel, for he has visited and redeemed his people, and has raised up a horn of salvation for us in the house of his servant David, as he spoke by the mouth of his holy prophets from of old, that we should be saved from our enemies and from the hand of all who hate us, to show the mercy promised to our fathers and to remember his holy covenant, the oath that he swore to our father Abraham to grant us, that we, being delivered from the hand of our enemies, might serve him without fear in holiness and righteousness before him all our days. And you, child, will be called the prophet of the Most High, for you will go before the Lord to prepare his ways, to give knowledge of salvation to his people in the forgiveness of their sins, because of the tender mercy of our God, whereby the sunrise shall visit us from on high, to give light to those who sit in darkness and in the shadow of death, to guide our feet into the way of peace." And the child grew and became strong in spirit, and he was in the wilderness until the day of his public appearance to Israel.
Well, I don't think I need to convince anyone here that love is a prominent theme at Christmas. It's something that we talk about. It's something that we think about so often. It's even to the point that we just get cards that just say love on them and a Christmas tree, and we think that's normal. Yeah, that makes sense. It's a time of love. Even so many of the movies that we watch in this time are about or resolved by love. I mean, Buddy the Elf falls in love with Jovi. Kevin McAllister learns to love his family after being left home alone. George Bailey learns to love his life, discovering, you know, it is in fact a wonderful life. Hans Gruber loves the money that they store at Nakatomi Plaza to the point that he's willing to die hard for it. Even our music as well points to this theme of love. So many of them actually end up just being love songs that take place when it's cold outside. We sing "All I Want for Christmas Is You," but recognize it doesn't always work out because last Christmas I gave you my heart, and now it's going to be a blue Christmas without you. All throughout the Christmas season, we talk about love or the loss of love. It is something that we focus on throughout. But in all these examples, it points to the idea of all these different meanings that we can have for this word love, that we can love stuff and things and animals. We can love people, but also love people different from one person to the next. And all of that is captured by one word, love. And yet, while we love these things, and while some of them are good, I emphasize some, while some of these things at Christmas are good, they pale in comparison to the greatest picture of love that there is, of all that Christmas points to, the love that God has for his people. When I think about this idea of God's love for his people, the passage that first comes to mind for me is 1 John chapter 4, which talks all throughout about God's love for his people. It says this in verse 7, "Beloved, let us love one another, for love is from God. And whoever loves has been born of God and knows God. Anyone who does not love does not know God, because God is love." I mean, just look at all that this passage talks about love. If only we were still in a Mark It Up, we could have a field day with this passage, right? Just circle every time you see love. We'll have to pass out new pens because we will run out. It's all throughout this passage. And it starts by calling God's people beloved. That this is what's said is true about his people. This is who you are. You are made lovely and loved by God. This is rooted in who you are. Your identity, God's beloved. I mean, how would we define a Christian? What is it that makes someone a Christian? Is it someone who's following Jesus? That's a good definition. I like that one. Is it people who go to church or read their Bible? Less of a good definition, but those are good things that Christians do. However we define it, let's not lose sight of the fact of the identity that's given to us that's not based off of what we do. It's not based off of how good you follow Jesus, how much you go to church. But this is what God says is true about you, that you are his beloved. This is who you are. This is what defines you. This is what makes you up as someone loved by God. And this makes sense as John continues in verse 7 as he says that love is from God. Love is from God. All love that we see in this world has its roots, is connected back to God as love is from God. Now, certainly we can love things that aren't helpful for us or aren't good for us. We can misuse this tremendous thing that God gives to us. But as we think about Christmas, how it's all talking about love, this makes sense because it's all connected to God. All love goes back to God, that he has made us in this way. We desire to know and be known by other people. We desire connection with others. We desire to be cared for by people. We seek out moments of heartfelt stories and tenderness because we're made for this. We were made for love. God made us in this way, made us to participate in love, made us as recipients of his love. This is what we've been made for. But he continues on in verse 8, that God is love. See, love doesn't just come from God. Love isn't just something that God does. It's who he is. God in his nature, what he's like, what makes up God. God is love. It's not an attribute that describes him. God is love. This means that he doesn't have some sort of switch that he can flick on or off depending on how he's feeling. Do I want to love today or not? He doesn't wake up one day and say, you know, I'm just not feeling it today. This is who God is. If there was ever a time when God stopped loving, he would stop being God. Because God is love. Always, for eternity, God is love. As we think about what love means, as we start to try to put together a definition of it, I think it all goes back to what this passage is saying. There's all these different meanings of what love is, but as we look to the God who is love, from whom all love proceeds, we might start to get a better understanding of it if we look to him rather than other places. And what we see all throughout the Bible is love is not some passive feeling, but it's an active position that people are in. See, love isn't something that just happens to us, as if we have no control over ourselves. You know, I didn't mean to, but I fell in love with someone else. I didn't mean to, but I fell out of love with you, as if there's no control. We're just the whims of our hearts. That's not what it is. Since God is love, since it all goes back to him, we see that love is not something fleeting. It's not seasonal. It's not finite, that it can run out. It can be exhausted. Now we look to God who is love, who is always loving towards you as our definition. And that's going to be bigger than what we tend to talk about with love, right? We say it's so important, it's such a big theme, and yet we have such a small understanding of it compared to the God who is love. We can love, but we're limited in it. God, however, is love. I love how John Stott captures this idea in a commentary on 1 John. He says, love is the very nature of God. If we're to not empty the word God of all of its meaning, we must realize that such an infinite, big, tremendous, holy God, yet personal creator, is not too great to be bothered with my tiny life. He is so great that he can be bothered with each of us individually. This is the picture of God's love for you, that he knows you. He knows all about you. And he does not leave us on our own to try to discover this. He doesn't create his love as some sort of puzzle that if we solve it, then we can finally understand what he's like. He doesn't leave us to try to stumble around until we happen to see, oh, God does love us. He reveals this. He shows us. He quite clearly makes this known. God's love for you is revealed. And he's not bothered by us. He's not someone that we have to win the affections of, that we have to prove our worthiness, but he's always accessible. He's always near, always caring. In other words, he is always love. I love the way that the hymn describes it. It says, oh, love that will not let me go. God and his love does not leave us alone. He doesn't let us go. He doesn't leave us on our own to try to figure things out, but instead he writes his love on our hearts, in the skies. Every corner of the universe radiates the phrase, God loves you. He makes this clear. He makes it known. His love is clear all throughout. And this shows in the fact that God does not leave us on our own. Now, this is different than the complaint I tended to get from my sisters growing up. It's not as though I can call my parents now and say, no, this was how I showed my love. Me pestering them, me being an annoying little twerp, was me not leaving them alone. That's loving. No, God is loving in this way because we are desperate for him. We need him. We are filled in him. And he doesn't force us to try to come to that conclusion by ourselves. He doesn't leave us to stumble and fall. That even though we turn away towards other things, we are made to receive love from him and we direct that to lesser things. We content ourselves with lesser loves. God does not leave us alone in that time, but pursues us, continues to go after us, continues to love. As we continue in 1 John chapter 4, we see this idea clearly in verse 9. It says, in this, the love of God was made manifest among us. It was revealed. It was made known. His love was in our very presence by God, in that God sent his only son into the world so that we might live through him. See, God most clearly shows his love in the sending of his son. The God who is always loves you makes that most clear at Christmas. Who pursues after us, does not leave us on our own, does not let us go, but instead joins after us, pursues after us, as the song said, runs after us to the point of becoming human to be with us, to the point of showing us that we can have life in him, to the point of remaining faithful when we were not acting beloved, he continued to demonstrate his love in the sending of his son. The clearest place that we see God's love for us is Christmas. But it's not as though this comes out of nowhere. It's not that God created this new plan, like, well, this could be a new way that I could show my love, or this is a new love that I have. No, God has always loved you. From the beginnings of the universe, from all time, God has loved you. He has constantly been showing and telling of his love for his people. And one of the great ways that he does that is in speaking to us, of revealing what he's like, of telling what he is, of showing us over and over of his great love for us. But even this is best seen at Christmas. Hebrews 1 says, God spoke in many times, in many ways in the past, but now he has most clearly spoken in his son. See, the Christmas story is an exclamation of God's love for you. Of what that love is like. It's inexhaustible. You can never run out, never cause it to expire. The Christmas story is a tender care of God pursuing his people. What was promised in Isaiah 40, that he would come and care for his sheep like a shepherd, that he would be tender and dear to them. That is what happens at Christmas. Oh, love that will not let me go. God reveals this to us, shows his pursuit of us, shows his love for us at Christmas. And the sending of his son, and then speaking to us. Now, there's certainly times where this does not feel like it's the case. Maybe we doubt God's love for us. We don't recognize, we don't feel God's love for us in a particular moment. And rather than hearing from the God who speaks to us, it seems like all we get is silence. Rather than seeing that God in his love does not leave us alone, we might feel alone. Or on our own. Well, this is where I appreciate another picture of God's love that's given to us in Luke chapter 1. Yes, we are actually going to go to Luke chapter 1. I didn't have Karen read it just because she did a great job of it. She did, but we are actually going to be in Luke chapter 1. God and his love does not leave us alone, but what about the times that it feels like it? Because there's certainly times all throughout the Bible that God's people have experienced times, seasons of silence. God has used these times to do some good, but one of the ways that he reveals his love is that he shatters the silence. God in his love shatters silence. There's a variety of places where God's people experience silence. I think of the book of Exodus, the second book in the Bible, where God's people were going through a famine, that there was a famine all throughout the land. And the way God cared for them was by leading them towards Egypt, this foreign land that they stayed in. They made homes for it. They ended up staying there for 400 years. And for most of that, they did not hear from God. They experienced silence. And for most of that, they were actually turned into slaves. It was a time of turmoil. And so they cried out to God. And the book of Exodus starts by saying, and God heard their cries. And he enters into human history. He rescues them. He shatters the silence to draw them near to him. After generations and generations of God caring for his people and them constantly turning towards other things, contenting themselves with lesser loves, God allowed his people to go into exile, to go again to a foreign land. And there's this poignant moment where the Israelites begin to hang up their instruments. They say, we're not going to bring these with us. We will not sing songs of praise in a foreign land. And yet after 70 years, God brings them back. And what we see them almost immediately do is shout for joy because God shattered the silence. In the time between the Old Testament and the New Testament, there's another 400-year period, 400 years of not hearing from God. But in Luke chapter 1, God shatters the silence. We're told of a man named Zechariah who was a priest, and he was chosen to be the priest to go and burn incense in the temple. It was a tremendous honor, a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. He would have been excited. He would have told his wife Elizabeth. They would have told everyone. This was an incredible moment, and yet when he's in the temple, something even greater happens as God shatters the silence. Well, that would have been astonishing enough to hear from God, that God speaks through an angel. First time in 400 years, that is astounding. And yet the message, the content of what is said is even greater. Because God speaks through this angel to tell Zechariah that you're going to be part of me showing the love that I have for everybody. That through you and your wife Elizabeth, that you will conceive of a child who will be the son for you, and you will name him John. And he will be the one who fulfills Isaiah 40, that he will prepare the way of the Lord. God gives this incredible message, this incredible promise to Zechariah. And Zechariah doubts. He doesn't believe it's going to happen. We read last week of Mary receiving a similar promise that through her, that she will miraculously conceive, have the son through whom God would make all things right. And she had concerns. She still had faith. Her question wasn't a lack of belief. She was concerned about how could this happen. Zechariah, though, doubts that it will happen. He demands for a sign. Let me see a promise. Let me receive something to know that this is actually going to take place the way that you say it's going to take place. He doubts in this moment. But God graciously gives him a sign. Not necessarily the sign he would have chosen, I don't think, because he's told that until his son is born, he will not be able to say anything. He will not be able to speak at all. An incredible turn of events. We see God shattering the silence, and yet Zechariah left in silence. And we don't often think of silence as a picture of love. And for good reason. If I, in my relationship with Emily, just stopped talking to her, that would not be a very loving thing to do. She would start questioning, am I doing something wrong? Is there a medical emergency? That would not be a good way to show her that I love and care about her. And yet what silence can do is it can help us to recognize that God is always with us, to help us recognize our need for him, to build our anticipation in him, that we are made to be with him, and it's in the silence, in the quiet that allows us to recognize that all the more. So what better thing is there? What more loving thing can God do than use this time to help us recognize our need and satisfaction in him? Silence is not a good way to show Emily that I love her. Silence is a way that we recognize our absolute dependence on God. It is a gift to do this. And after 400 years of silence, rather than this being a time for Zechariah that builds anticipation, for him to expect to hear from God, long to hear from God, when he finally does, he doesn't believe. He doubts. And maybe we can be like that. Maybe we long to hear from God, to experience his love in our life, for him to break the silence that we feel, but we miss what he's doing or doubt what he's doing. I mean, I think about Zechariah. He's in the temple. He's doing the special work for God, and he's missing the special work that God is doing in him. Or we seek to follow Jesus, but we miss the direction that Jesus is taking us. And in these times of silence, we don't love them. We don't like the sitting in the stillness. We don't like not knowing. We want clarity from God. We want a direction. We want, all right, give me a step-by-step plan of what you want me to do, God. And in those times that we don't receive that, we just want the silence to end. And we can miss the purpose that God is doing in the midst of it. We can miss this longing, this anticipation, this recognition of God's love being perfect for us in the silence. Do we use the silence well? We're in this Christmas season that's meant to be a pause, a time to reflect, to be still. Is it just so full of stuff that we're not able to build this longing, this anticipation, the recognition of the love that comes from the God who is love? Silence can be such a gift from God because it helps us to recognize all the more his love. But there's two sides to this coin. We see God's love in the silence, and we see God's love in breaking the silence because he never leaves his people there. That's what makes it loving. If he never revealed himself, never spoke, and just left us to figure things out, that would not be loving. There's two sides to this coin. And God never leaves his people in the silence. We see that in Luke chapter 1. That God made this promise to Zechariah and he doubted and he didn't just leave him there. He didn't say, fine, I'll find someone else. I'll go somewhere else. But he continued to pursue, continued to show his love. And everything that he promised would take place happens. Elizabeth, Zechariah's wife, conceives and gives birth to this son. And it's this incredible moment. The whole village, we're told, is celebrating. They're like, this is incredible. We thought you were too old. We knew you were too old for this. This is a miracle. So they start asking her, what's the name of your child going to be? And Elizabeth says, John. And everyone like, oh, you don't mean that. That's not a family name. You wouldn't name him that. So let's go above your head. Let's go to dad and see what the name is actually going to be. And Zechariah still can't speak, so he motions for a writing utensil. And he writes down just a very simple statement, but it reveals so much. Before he doubted, but now he believes. Before he was faithless, but now he has full faith. Before he did not recognize God's loving act, but now he fully does. Because he just writes down very simply, his name is John. And it's in that very act, this moment of obedience, of trust, of belief, of recognizing the love that God was pouring out on him, that he is able to speak for the first time ever since he was given this promise. So 9, 10 months before, finally able to speak. And the words that he has are just praise, adoration, love in response to the love of God. And he recites God's faithfulness throughout Israel's history, him keeping his promises, but then begins to sing of his son. It's a beautiful moment where the way that it's worded is like he's turning to his child. And you, child, this is who you will be. You'll be called the prophet of the Most High, verse 76. That God will use you to break the silence for other people as well. That he will speak through you to others. That you will be the one who goes before the Lord to prepare his ways, fulfilling Isaiah chapter 40. That you will be able to give knowledge of salvation and the forgiveness of sins, the love that God has for his people. But then he begins to sing about another son, a son that's given to us on Christmas. And we talked about so many of our songs at Christmas are about love. And this is no different. Because it says, because of the tender mercy of our God, whereby the sunrise shall visit us from on high to give light to those who sit in darkness and in the shadow of death, to guide our feet into the way of peace. Because of the tender mercy of our God. I mean, what greater picture do we have to give us of God's love for us, his tender mercy, his heartfelt desire, his care, his grace that he pours on. I love the way Isaiah 40 talks about that God himself will come and care for us like a shepherd cares for sheep. We're given so many mental pictures of word images to see God's dear love. Because of his tender mercy, because of his love for you, he will send one from on high who will come into this world to give light for those in darkness and guide our feet to the way of peace. I mean, this is what we read, a little bit less poetically, but nonetheless important in 1 John 4:9. The way we know God's love is by the sending of his son. Because of the tender mercy of God, he has done this great thing for us. But notice that this only happens after a period of silence. Zechariah was told this was going to be true, doubted it, and was left in silence. But it's in that time that he built anticipation, that he recognized God's loving act for him, that it's the moment of silence that God worked within to show Zechariah more clearly what he's doing. It was in the silence that he worked through this man to show him that what he says is true. It was in the silence that Zechariah was able to, over these months, write these words on his heart, even if they weren't written before. That this praise, this faithfulness comes because God worked through him in the silence. See, Advent is a time that is meant to be a pause, a time of stillness, a time of quiet, a time of silence. Because it's in those moments that we are able to see the love of God more clearly. But I know we don't want to stay there. We don't like the quiet. So much of our life is full. We jam-pack our schedule. There's not moments to pause. There's not times of stillness. We just go from thing to thing to thing. Or even when we have moments, it's turn the TV on right away. We're in the car. We're listening to music. We put on a podcast or an audiobook. We have a soundtrack to our life at almost every possible time. We don't like these moments of stillness, of quiet. There could be a variety of reasons for that. Maybe we, when left to our own thoughts, we can go down some interesting rabbit trails. Or maybe it is that we think that something is wrong in the silence. Something must not be going right if I'm not hearing from God, if I don't feel as close to him. But what we see is that God is just as loving in the silence as he is when he shatters the silence. And Advent is a time that can help prepare us for that, where we pause and reflect and be still and look at the truth of Jesus entering in this world. Look at the truth of the love that God shows by the sending of his son. Look at how God has revealed his love, constantly showing and telling us of what that's like. To build anticipation for the day that that silence is shattered. To build anticipation of him making all things new. When we won't need silence anymore, when we won't need to long to see God because we will be with him face to face. But until that time, we take silence. We take these moments to pause, to build this anticipation, to recognize our need, to recognize all the more his love for us. We need the silence to remember that the love of God breaks through, to remember that God does not leave us there. See, without this pause, without the stillness of Advent, we could just become numb. We could become used to it. We could become like Zechariah, who was so 400 years of silence. He was so used to it that he lost this longing, this anticipation. That even when he's in the temple, the place where God's presence was, where he's doing this special work from God, he completely misses that God is speaking to him in that time. It's baffling to me. How can you miss this in the temple? Until I remember how much time I spend here at church, how much time I spend with God's people, and how little I recognize God's love for me. We need these pauses. We need the stillness. We need the silence to help us see more clearly God's love for us. And so, we're gonna do that. In a moment, I'm gonna pray, and then we're gonna have an opportunity to take just a few moments of silence to reflect on this love that God has poured out for us, to reflect on the truth that God breaks silence, to reflect on the truth that God is making all things new by the sending of a son. So it's an opportunity for us to remember that this is where we were. We were in a place of silence with God. When we didn't know him, when we weren't following him, when we did not see clearly his love, as we sang earlier, in the darkness, we were waiting without hope and without light. That is where we were. As we take these times to be still, to be silent, we remember where God has brought us from. It also builds the longing for the day when Jesus comes back and silence will be nevermore. when we will not need to build anticipation because all things have been fulfilled. So we're going to take a moment of silence. But I recognize that this is going to be uncomfortable for some of us. We're not practicing this. We don't like doing this. We don't like to sit in the silence. So that's why I think it might be helpful for us to fill our mind with remembrance, to build this anticipation, to look towards this loving God who has constantly shown his love to us. As we sit, as we're still, as we pause, we do so knowing that God is loving now, as he always has been, as he always will be. Let me pray, then we can take this moment. Father, you are a God who knows our limitations, our lack, our limits that we have. And yet you are the God who constantly reveals that you are with us, constantly gives us ways that we can know, ways that we can greater experience this. That even in the times that it feels like we are missing something, that you don't seem near, that you seem absent, that we feel alone, that is never true. That even these times that we don't feel as loved by you, we are just as loved now as we ever will be. That it's actually in these times, it's building a longing, building anticipation, building excitement for the day that we know is coming. So let us use this time not as merely another thing to do, to stop, something to add to this season, but let it be a time that's fulfilling all that you mean for it, that it's in the stillness, in the quiet, that we can best see your love for us. So it's to you and you alone we pray.